Session number 12884. Workers from the Supermarine Works in Southampton, Reel 3.
Other word for it. It was a terror to work for. You were straight out the gate if you made one mistake.
Got the work done, didn't you?
Oh, we got the work done, yes. Yes. But you could, right opposite the main gate, entering the main works, there was the Oak Tree pub.
That's,
remember,
yes,
the Oak Tree,
right,
pub?
Royal Oak.
And every day you could see four or five men with their toolboxes and perhaps two or three lads waiting for someone to get the sack so they could dip in and ask, see if they could get their job.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
That's a
so
fact.
You didn't get any trade unions did you?
Well, you never had trade unions.
Well, I would work with trade unions. There would have been a conflict there, wouldn't there?
Absolutely.
The sort of thing you get is, like, you wouldn't get today, and I think young lads today would be surprised that 7:30 in the morning, we work 47-hour week. You work from 7:30 till 12, 1 o'clock till 5, and then if you're an apprentice, you could work until 7 o'clock in the evening, two nights a week. But the point was that in the mornings and lunchtime, the starting the buzzer went, you had to be there with a file or something in your hand. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you had the charge and standing behind you.
Yeah.
Saying, aren't you going to do anything today?
Yes.
That's right.
There's no question of, 5 minutes. We'd have a look at the paper or something like that. Well, I had seen him for him since I left there, but
if you wanted,
you
to
had to be there on the job.
If you wanted to renew that file, you had to take it down to Jim Weedy.
Oh, yeah.
He'd take a look at it, and if you thought there was another 2 hours work on it, you'd tell him to take it back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was a queer sort of individual, really. He'd jump over benches to get at you, so as he'd get at you, and you daren't laugh and you daren't talk to anyone.
What was he officially? Was he a workman?
He was a foreman.
He
was the foreman. He was P shop foreman.
Mm. He used to stand at the K shop where they used to build the holes, and they used to have a balcony right the way around where you said Mills and
Bert Heaver's shop.
Yeah, he'd shop. Me,
and he'd stand down in the down below and he'd look all around, and if he saw two men standing close together talking, whether they're talking or not, whether they're staying close together, I'd never get the speed from him. He used to dash across the shop, up the stairs, and he'd come up behind them, and aren't you going to do anything? And if they didn't have a reasonable excuse, they went.
Apart from that, he was well liked.
Yes. I've known people start at 7:30, and 10 o'clock they've been on their way out again.
Yeah.
And if you did get the sack from Supermarine at all for any misdemeanor, you didn't have a chance of getting a job, because he'd ring up all the firms and say that, you know, an undesirable. So
you were pretty brave people applying for a job there then, weren't you?
We didn't know, did we, you see?
I joined because it was aeroplanes, isn't it?
That's right.
Can you remember your clock number?
B183, my first one was F73, and it's the same number.
But if ever you tried to take shorthand dictation from Mr. Elliot, he was works manager, he never sat still in the chair. He'd put his hands behind him, like Prince Philip, you know, and walk up and down. And he had a little fat tummy.
Yeah.
And his tummy rested on his belt. And as he walked up and down the office, you'd have to chase behind him with your shorthand pad. He'd be dictating all the time, and you're trying to get it down. He'd probably, the afternoon tea had arrived, and he'd have a piece of bread and jam stuck in his mouth as well, dictating. And it used to put the fear of the Lord up. You're chasing him around the office to take his dictation because his little fat tummy was wobbling all the time and you were scared stiff he wasn't going to be decent.
But he was a nice man.
Oh, I like this.
He was a very, very nice man.
So was Westbrook, really. If you did your job proper. Oh, yes. If you did your.
It's nice of you to tell me. I wouldn't know otherwise.
Oh, wouldn't you?
No.
If you did, well, we found him. If you did your job properly and if you had a dispute, you took it up with him. In a decent manner, yeah. He would listen to you.
Yeah.
Oh yes, I found him a very fair man.
Well, I always took the idea that nobody's perfect. Unless you were perfect, you were no friend of Westbrook's.
No, this is right.
And one particular man walked through the shop and didn't stop.
Fair enough.
The hammers and all sorts come flying across.
Yes,
the
oh yes.
Yeah,
was that Armistice Day?
Yeah, they threw hammers at him and anything that's they could lay their hands on, there was an uproar.
It was very impressive, though, wasn't it? Because one second, machinery all over the place, it was hell on earth let loose,
and
you know.
And all of a sudden, whoosh.
What siren sounded, didn't it? Just a few seconds before, and then everybody, dead silence, and in the office. I can remember every man, and woman for that matter, rose quietly to their feet.
That's
it was really reverently respected.
Yeah. The air raid practices.
Yeah.
And we used to have to run up that road right up to the Itchen Works and under the bridge into the shelter. Well, during one of these practices, old Quill made a dive. He made a dive to simulate them, and that decided me, no way would I go to the shelter. And thank God I didn't, because that was the one that got a direct hit. Yeah.
Can we move on a bit now to the, if you like, the post Mitchell days? You gentlemen have spoken quite a lot about it, but I've been trying to get back to a little chronology and your memories really of the late 30s and through the war years. It was Joe Smith who took over from
R.J.
Mitchell, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And then of course you all got scattered and
that's right
during the war.
Yeah,
can you tell me, we stopped after Mitchell's death.
That's right.
With you, Mrs. Gray.
Well,
can you carry on from
not
there?
For very long, because of course I left the firm in 1937 prior to my marriage.
Ah.
So I haven't any real memories after that.
You may leave now.
Oh, thank you.
No, but I'd be interested to know your experiences, you know, as you geared up for war and you had to really turn out these aeroplanes quickly and so on, how it affected your lives. Presumably you were all on reserved occupations, you stayed in the works.
Yeah.
Well, I did get a call up once.
Yeah.
1943.
I must admit that after I married and the war had started, I had a call back from the old firm, would I go back? But I couldn't by now. I had been immediately pushed in charge of Totten Civil Defence Headquarters. I couldn't, but I would have liked to have gone back very much.
Were you all in Southampton in the early days of the war then?
All at Itchen Works.
Until the bomb.
And Woolston Works. Until it was bombed out.
I went up to Eastleigh then from Eastleigh to Seawards, and Seawards to Reading to 1944.
We were billeted 8 in Trowbridge. I remember 4 of us being billeted in one house, and the chap with his wife, he was a butcher, so we did very well.
Very nice
meals.
I didn't do so good. I was at work on the Friday, and I was told Friday night, pack up, either sell your house or do something about it, take the wife with you and go to Trowbridge. And that's what I did. I had previously been working at Hants and Dorset and Seawards, and I just went one day on April the 1st, the biggest April Fool I ever made, and it snowed like the heck, didn't know where I was going. Couldn't find the place, got stuck in one room with no heating at all, until eventually we got one of the Air Ministry bungalows, which they called the Hutmans at Rutland Crescent, where the wife and I had to stay there until 1950, or at least my wife lived there, because when I applied for a house back in Southampton, they said, oh, we don't reserve houses for the like of you, only servicemen. And it was a long time. I lived in Diggs in Southampton for 18 months before I got a house.
I became a BBC star at Trowbridge.
Did you?
Mm. Did a couple of recordings on the BBC Works Wonders programme.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hamilton Kennedy, BBC producer.
Mm-hmm.
He came down and held auditions to see if he could get a half an hour programme of talent war workers, they used to call them. And we did one programme live, and a few months later did a recorded programme. Recorded on the Wednesday and came and listened to it being recorded on the Saturday.
Yeah,
but never got into any big time or anything.
No.
How did things change in the factory, you know, when you had a lot of additional wartime only people coming in?
Radically, yes. Radically they changed.
Can you tell me a bit about it?
Well, yeah, I can, because at that time I was in charge of the leading edge shop, and all of a sudden we had the incursion of women. And everybody had to have a woman, a lady working with them.
Lovely.
Well, I'll tell you what, most of the time they just stood and watched what you did and took half your bonus, which annoyed us very much, because, I mean, they weren't an asset. They were just foisted on you.
There were the exceptions. I had one in Reading.
Oh, yeah.
I had one in Reading, a young girl, and they said, you've got to have her with you. I said, mention the names. I said, no way. I was at coming at the time then. I was, no way I'm going to have a girl or a woman working with me. I mean, you've got to have her, insist on it. I said, well, if she comes, I'm not going to show her anything. I was very different about it. I was working on a pneumatic system, which is a series of airline pipes and that, copper pipes, and it's quite complicated in the bottom of the copper of the aircraft. It fed the guns, it fed the flaps with air, and it was quite a business. So we fit all these in a bit, so 20 or 30 pipes, and unions and connections, the air bottles and everything. And she came with me, and she stood by the cockpit door while I put all these pipes in. And that got right to the last part where we had to test the airlines and get it ready for inspection. So she watched me on that, and okay, we got that aircraft cleared, no leaks and that. Went on to the next aircraft, and to my surprise, she said, oh, she said, do you mind if I try it? I said, do you think you can do it? She said, oh, yes. So I've been watching you. So I said, free, give her a free hand. So I stood by and watched her. And giving her due respect, she got every pipe in position, she got everything in as it should be, fairies and all that sort of thing. And in the end, she said, well, she says, the testing, she said, would you carry the testing for leaks, because I didn't quite follow that. And after that, we got on marvellous together.
I don't remember too many women at Southwark. There were a lot at Bradley Road, but I don't remember.
There were some
many
at Southwark. Yeah.
I know there were some, but not.
Yeah, not a lot. They're mostly on the skinning section. They were mostly not in the structure. Well, they were in the structure, and the final operations on the leading edge. There were mostly women. In old Elliot's shop there. No. I was a charge hand in there at the time when the women came in there.
The George Hutchinson.
Yeah. And it was the most difficult job of my life, trying to get women to do the job.
I mean, they'd had some basic training, skill training, hadn't they, before they came?
No.
Purely on the job training?
Purely came straight in. And it's where I learnt a lot of swear words that I never knew existed.
I don't remember women being employed as riveter holder arms.
No, they never did. The noise was terrific. The noise of the riveting on the loop, you could just imagine 1,000 people beating drums. You couldn't hardly speak to anybody. The noise was colossal.
This has had an effect over the years, I think.
On my hearing.
It's not too bad, but it's definitely got a defect now.
Yeah.
As you get older, and I put it down to, as you say, the workshops, the riveting and all that, working day after day. Also up at the airport, standing behind the aircraft when they're doing their engine run-ups,
yeah,
holding onto the blocks, the chocks.
And middle age coming on, Dennis. I'm not looking forward to it, really.
The what? Oh, yeah. Well, there were.
Dick, have you got anything to say on this? Were you involved in Super Marines? I'm sorry,
no.
I kept you out on the brink of things.
No, I went into the Air Force after serving initially with the post office in the telecom part. I went in the Air Force in 1941 and came out again in 1945. But as a youth, my pal and I used to cycle around the local airfields, and we haunted what we called Atlantic Park in those days.
Easily.
Yes, it was known as Atlantic Park because after the First World War, the hangars and so on housed a number of emigrants in transit from Europe to North America. Well, we used to go out there and see various things. My first flight was from Eastleigh Airport, and it was in a Spartan three-seater at one of the air circus.
Cobham's.
Cobham, either Cobham or Captain Barnard, I can't remember
Cobham's.
Which. Cobham, yeah.
Yeah.
As I say, we used to haunt this place, and I can remember seeing an S6 fuselage hanging on the wall of the hangar. And, you know, after it had been dismantled, and it was stored on, hanging on the wall there. And we also used to see the 220, was it? The forerunner of the Spitfire, the gull-winged.
That's right.
Aircraft.
Yeah.
And we used to think it was wonderful. We used to call it the superplane,
yeah.
My pal and I. We were about 14, you see. Mm. And, of course, I don't know why, but we didn't seem to see the Spitfire itself.
Well, it came afterwards, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But we used to go around to Hamble and into the air service training. Nobody stopped us, just wander around, you know. And we went as far as High Post and on our bikes. And I can remember getting back to our wartime service, I can remember seeing the Supermarine float planes that were built being tested off Netley Hospital, taxiing trials, I suppose, and I believe I remember seeing one take off. But I can remember seeing the S6 or one of its like, you know, one aircraft like it when we first came to live in Southampton. I heard this aircraft engine and I rushed outside. I must have been about 11, and there it was, and I've never seen anything so fast at the time, because hitherto the only aeroplanes I'd seen had been the occasional Southampton, which when we lived at Penzance used to come and moor in Mounts Bay and pay sort of official visits to Penzance and things like that, and they seemed to hang in the air at about, I don't know how many knots they did, but they weren't very many. But,
good headwind, they fly backwards.
More or less. Yes, that's about my experience. Oh, I did see the attack on the works. I believe it was a Saturday, was it? Was it a Saturday?
Well, Thursday.
Midweek.
It was midweek. Tuesday and Thursday. Tuesday the 23rd, and I think it was Thursday the 25th.
Well, we had some friends who lived at Rownham's, and we used to take refuge out there from the attacks, like lots of other people did. And I actually saw these aircraft attack, and some of them attacked from high level, didn't they?
That's right.
And I remember seeing them peeling off for their dive.
That's right. I met the commander of that squadron some years later.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
It has been alleged that the Germans captured some Blenheims and used them, but
no.
That's been categorically denied.
No, it wasn't true.
No.
And they had the nasty attackers there then, but I had a short period on that, and then I went on what they call the 508, which eventually became the Scimitar. And then there's the Swift being built there at the same time. I occasionally worked on that. But then we had to go up to Chilbolton to do repairs on petrol tanks and that sort of thing.
That's right.
On the Swift.
Because they had a lot of problems on the Swift, didn't they?
Yeah, so on the Swift, it was a very awkward aircraft to work on, actually. I don't know if you gentlemen found it.
I did.
But was on the wings, working on the wings on, and there we had the vertical rib for the what they call the end rib, and then the main spar coming at an angle where it was swept back. The holes on the bottom there had to be what they call B-fit and A-fit holes. You had to drill in a very short space with an angle drill through the ribs, and then ring them out to the size so the plug gauge wouldn't go in, or would go in properly, which meant you only had about 2 or 3 inches to work in. And when the talk resulted in almost
very difficult job to do.
On that period of aircraft, that's one of the most awkward jobs I've ever had.
And most of the holes on the Spitfire had to be B-fit.
Oh yes.
B-fit and A-fit.
Yes, you could get them, you know, especially the rear end on the Spitfire. Up in Eastleigh, you used to have two men up there used to do that, nothing else but ream these tape with a mobile reamer. Remember it?
Why did that be reamed?
You had 7 holes in the main spars, front main spar, which had to be reamed out on the rib 5, which was the first rib in front of the engine, behind the engine. The first rib of the fuselage was rib 5. Well, on the base of that was the attachments, or the primary member for the attachment of the wings, where the root end of the wings came in, fitted in onto.
That's the root. The root frame.
Yeah. Mm.
Frame 5 was the root frame,
and those holes in there had to be reamed out for the plug gauge, so that when they did join up together, the bolts were in were the right size.
Or
well,
used to have tape of reamers, so that you could ream the
holes. Well, they used to be done on a big jig. They used to ream the holes on this big jig with a vertical drill above it. And they used to set the pintle on that job as well.
Right, yeah.
Set the pintle and ream the 7 holes. And they were done with a specially grained reamer to produce the size of hole, and then they had to be checked every time. And it was very difficult because the boom was laminated. It wasn't a solid boom. It was one tube pulled inside the other. And of course, when you put pressure on it, they closed and opened, you see. Very difficult job, but they did achieve a very good job. They used to drive, the root bolts used to be driven in with a bullet shaped end which screwed on the end of the bolt, and you knocked it in, then took the bullet off. Doing that?
Or your nuts were torque.
That's right. And then
torque loaded.
But he was quite right. And I was at Eastleigh. Were you at Eastleigh?
Yes, I was Eastleigh.
Well, I was Eastleigh, and I was charging on the wings at that time.
That was George Marriott.
That's right. It was a very difficult job, the Swift. And as they get it, of course, all the wing was a petrol tank as well, and to be able to get it leak-proof, it was no easy job, was it? But I mean, the Swift was a colossal failure.
It's very spectacular. I remember seeing it at Farnborough. The different stages of it, the 501 and the 535.
That's right.
Yeah. you've told me a lot about Supermarines in the 30s, and have given me the impression that there was a certain family atmosphere there, although a very fierce one, a strict Victorian household sort of thing.
Yeah.
Presumably, you know, you were all scattered during the war, and you may have come back and so on, but that atmosphere, for good or ill, didn't survive the war, did it?
No.
It wasn't
a miserable place to work in. I mean, I can remember having good laughs and good pals, good friends. It wasn't. I don't remember ever being that miserable there. You know,
we put it this way: that over the period of years, we've all just sort of dispersed, as you say, and we come back together again. And once a year in October, we have the Supermarines Association Society, which are the people who worked for the Supermarine and Vickers in those days. And every year, the Echo Office of St Anton, we have this meeting and a reunion. And it's quite an interesting evening. And it's amazing, you walk, you go from one side of the room to the other side of the room to get to the bar to get a drink. And you normally do it in about half a minute, it takes you somewhere about half an hour. Where you get people saying, "Oh, I know you.
That's right.
What was your name there? Where did you work? And it's marvellous to meet the people that you knew years ago.
I recognise you. You cut your hair.
Oh yeah. Pardon? I'll tell you an interesting story. 1965, I went to Germany with the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, which I'm a member. And I had to go. We went to visit the Messerschmitt Works. I went in the works there, and I'm walking through the design office, and a voice yells out, "Oh, you old so-and-so, what are you doing here?" And I thought, blimey, that bloke speaks good English for a German. And it was one of the old supermarine lads. And there was about 30 of them working in the Messerschmitt design office. Because when supermarine broke up, the Germans brought a trailer over here to the Polygon Hotel, and signed up everybody they could from Supermarine, anyone they could get from Supermarine to go over there and work. I had the offer. They took them to Germany.
But they weren't building aeroplanes then, were they?
Yes, they were.
Were they?
Yes, they were. 1950. They were building aeroplanes then. Yeah.
What about Joe Smith? Was he as mercurial a character around the works as Mitchell or not? I mean, did he come down the shops a lot?
Well, I never had any contact with him like I did with Reg Mitchell.
Mm. He was a nice man. Yeah, he was a nice man. He talked to you, and especially when I was with in the test house. What was his name in the test house?
Alan Clifton.
Huh?
Alan Clifton.
Yeah. Well, I was in the test house for a while, and then we used to do various tests on different metals, you know. At least I wasn't doing the test. I was in... not taken recordings of it, you know. And old Joe Smith would come in, and he was a very amiable man. You know, swarthy type of chap, but very nice man. I found him to be a very nice man.
I suppose, I mean, there was a certain amount of Mitchell's quality that enabled the Spitfire to evolve through so many marks, so it ended up flying twice as high and twice as fast, but I would imagine it was down to Joe Smith to work on this good basic design and get the performance out of it.
He was a disciple of RJ.
He was a disciple. He got as much credit as he deserves.
He didn't get anywhere near the credit he deserved. He didn't. Because he evolved the Spitfire into something which was nothing like the first one.
That was the last one down there, Mark 24. And the variations over the period fantastic.
Yeah. Well, the last one I worked on was the 47th Spitfire. Seafire. It was the 47th Seafire. I was in charge of that at Bradley Road. I don't know if you were there then.
Squadron Leader Payne had quite a bit to do with it too, didn't he? The Squadron Leader Payne.
Last
Spitfire was the Seafang and Spiteful.
That's right.
That is another development of the Spitfire, which is more advanced than ever.
Of course, the jets came in and that washed it out.
Well, apparently, unfortunately, they didn't put enough. They wanted to do more streamlining. They cut down on the amount of manholes or handholes that you could do your maintenance on. We produced eight of them from Chalmers Ford down to East.
And these works, right?
Yeah, they went to the Air Force, and the military put an order in for 17. We completed 8, and then the Air Force found they couldn't carry out the maintenance they should do on them, and the whole idea was scrapped. What happened then? We carried on completing the aircraft. They're still being pre-production at Chalmers Ford. Fuselage was taken down to Eastleigh, completed, taken on test flight, approved,
right.
Brought in, dismantled, put on lorries, taken up north and scrapped.
Who was the foreman?
17 aircraft from me.
Where?
Janus one.
Ted Henry,
that's right.
Ted Henry. But the you're not quite right in one way, because with the 371, the development of the laminar flow wing was evolved, which proved very successful, which was used on preceding aircraft, not only supermarine aircraft but other aircraft as well. But what wiped out the 371 was the emergence of the jet. When the Gloucester flew and we'd won the war and they brought back the German jet developments, piston aircraft were no good. Not for war, they were no good. They were obsolete. It wiped them all out.
They incorporated the